Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
It's 5 minutes after 6 o'clock on this 10th day of September. Very good evening to you and welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm Duduzile Ramela in for Jimmy Moyaha this evening. Here's what you can look forward to. We're going to be speaking to Chantal Marks. She's head of research at FNB Wealth and Investments, talking all things markets in terms of how we fared today. We also look at results from ATTAC. They have upped their income. Raj Nana is the CFO of ATTAC. We also look at food producer Lipstar. Their revenue is up 5%. We also look at infrastructure development and investment on the African continent. Asanda Tsotsi is head of project and export finance at Standard Bank CIB. We also take a look at trade agreements between China and South Africa, more so when it comes to the agricultural sector.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Our market watcher this evening, Chantal Marks, head of research at FNB Wealth and Investments. Chantal, thank you very much for your time this evening. Let's start with a market wrap.
Yes, so we actually had a pretty decent day on the market relative to global markets. The JSE managed to eke out a 0.25% gain on the day, really a function of a strong performance by the financial sector, as well as the small and mid-cap space. We saw resources come under pressure, down about 1.6% today. And that was really led by the gold miners, so AngloGold and Harmony being the weakest performers of the top 100 today. And then on the plus side, a really strong positive move by Premier Group. That's the bread producer after a sell-side upgrade there. And then also Sappi and Itaaltal standing out to me. I thought Itaaltal was quite an interesting one because we did have building confidence numbers come out yesterday that showed that space of the market really feeling very good around what's ahead, I think, in the context of interest rates coming down and perhaps consumers having a little bit more disposable income to spend on DIY projects and the like. The rand was kind of middle of the road relative to the big currencies today, but slightly weaker, down. Slightly weaker, ever so slightly weaker today, down 0.4% against the US dollar.
Let's take a look at the August CPI report, which is due on Wednesday. It will offer some insight into inflationary pressures and consumer spending patterns. What are you looking forward to the most?
Yes, so we have headline inflation out of the US that's expected to come down quite a bit. Well, in the context of inflation, it's a small move is always a big deal. But the core measure is expected to stay above 3%. The Fed really has that 2% target that they're always speaking to. I think, though, if we get a surprise to the downside, so if inflation is lower than expected, then I think there will be more talk around a possible 50 basis point cut by the US Fed. In its meeting on the, I think the 18th is when the decision is made. Now, obviously, if it's higher than expected, then I think investors will cement in that 25 basis point rate cut. But I do think that the rate cut is on the cards. I can't see them not going through with that.
Okay. Let's go back to the JSE because the Financial Sector Conduct Authority has approved amendments to its listing requirements that will allow it to split its main board into two distinct segments. Meaning what, essentially?
Well, I think that the idea is that you do have the main board that kind of caters to or a specific board that caters to bigger companies and then another board that caters to slightly smaller companies. I'm not exactly sure what the ultimate impact around it will be, but the JSE has been trying to simplify its requirements for some time, and the JSE has tried to attract more listings to the bourse as well. I mean, we know that over the last 2 or 3 years, we've seen a string of delistings, not necessarily only because of onerous regulatory requirements, but also because the South African market has been very undervalued and a lot of stocks have been takeover targets as a result. But I'm not sure exactly what the outcome is going to be or whether or not it's going to have a massive impact, but I think the JSE will be quite happy.
Okay. So the two-pot retirement system, which is on everyone's lips, including a popular food outlet, rather. Let's talk about that because a number of companies have been talking about how much they've processed, Alex Forbes being the latest, processing withdrawals worth some 1.5 billion rand in a week. Which stocks will benefit the most, do you perceive?
Yes, so we think that the discretionary retailers will benefit the most. So those are basically clothing and furniture retailers. The reality is that the cap is quite small. So we're not necessarily going to see someone being able to go out and buy a new car, for example. Mm. But it will give that spending power. And then I hope a lot of investors make a good decision. And if they withdraw from that pot, they actually decide to pay down some debt. And that, I think, will be quite positive for the banks, because some of some consumers are under a lot of pressure and struggling to service their debt. And I'm hoping that it will improve the credit quality for the banks as well.
What's going on with oil prices?
Well, oil prices are under a lot of pressure. So for South Africa, that's quite a good thing, because we're a net importer of oil. And I think it will be quite positive from a trade balance perspective. But the weak oil price really is a reflection of concerns around the demand outlook for oil. And that, I think, is centered on the softness that we've seen in the Chinese economy. And then also pressure felt across the world because of very high interest rates. We know there are concerns over the US economy as well. Europe is struggling to gain traction at the moment, really requiring those interest rate cuts to bolster those underlying economies. I think that the fear now is that that won't be enough to boost demand for oil, because economic growth might take a while to catch up.
What of gold? What's putting the pressure there?
Well, yeah, it's quite difficult. I mean, gold is at very high levels still. So it does reflect that we are still in an environment that is facing a lot of uncertainty, particularly from a geopolitical and a political perspective. But I mean, gold does from time to time react to different things that's happening in the market, and perhaps other asset classes looking a little bit more attractive on a relative basis. We've also seen a little bit of dollar strength, so that could also explain some of the weakness in gold.
Right. We're going to be speaking to Raj Nana of Attack, as well as Charles de Villiers of Lipstar, on their results. What's been your interpretation?
Yes, so those were probably the standout companies in terms of results today. Attack, really a very, very strong print, with distributable income per share up almost 20% and the dividend increasing by 19%. And this is on the back of several years of very tepid growth in the South African property space, and kind of investors having gotten used to the fact that dividends or distributions would increase in kind of the low single digits. So really strong numbers by Attack. The market really liked it a lot as well. I see the share price closed up 3.2%, but it was much higher than that intraday. And then Lipstar also, I thought, printed pretty decent results. That share price was a little bit more volatile today, but I do see that they did end up a little bit higher on the day as well. We had pretty soft growth when it came to the revenue line, and that's a function of volumes coming under pressure because consumers are so constrained at the moment. But some of the things that they're really trying to do, like pushing through production efficiencies and becoming more efficient in the way that they run these separate businesses, is really starting to pay off, because we did see a really nice jump in the normalized earnings per share number of about 11.5%. And I think that there's probably more to come, given what management said around their outlook as well.
Thank you so much, Chantal, for your time and your contribution this evening. Chantal Marx is Head of Research at FNB Wealth and Investments.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next episode of Fix SA on MoneyWeb. I'm in conversation with the former chief executive of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and soldier, Roy Anderson. We'll be looking at leadership style and approach when it comes to solving problems, comparing the role of discipline in military and civilian leadership, and strategies for setting and achieving goals under pressure. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to the Market Update on SAFM.
the owners of Mall of Africa and Garden Route Mall. ATAC today announced a healthy set of results for the full year ending 30 June 2024. The company reported full year dividend growth of 19.0% to 69 cents per share, with distributable income per share increasing by 19.9% to 86.2 cents. Operationally, the group delivered a sturdy performance, with the occupancy rate rising to 92.8% and collection rates remaining high at 100.2%. It is also positioned for growth with developments at Waterfall City. We speak now to Raj Nana. He is the Chief Financial Officer at ATAC. He's on the line for more. Thank you very much, Raj, for your time this evening. Perhaps you can characterize the results for us. How would you?
Yeah, I think very pleased with the set of results we released this year. I think in a very tough operating environment, to grow your distributable income per share by almost 20% is quite a surprise to the market, and we've received a lot of positive feedback. And I think, we've also positioned our outlook for next year, and we've guided the market to a further 20% growth. So overall, a good set of results, and I think it'll continue into the next financial year as well.
Right. Your balance sheet has also been further strengthened, no doubt something that makes you sleep well at night.
Absolutely. So I think partly what's contributed to both the very good income statement results or growth in distributable income per share has also contributed to the very healthy balance sheet, gearing at 25.4%. And that, like I said, part of that is attributable to the transaction that we did with the GEPF in October last year, where they acquired 30% of Waterfall City. And we used all of those proceeds to pay down debt and get us to the position where we are. And that, coupled with our development pipeline in Waterfall, of both warehouses and logistics, as well as some offices, etc., we've got the balance sheet to roll that out. So I think a very good position to be in what's still, I think, quite a tough market. We're very pleased to be in this position.
What of the exiting of your minority investment in MAS PLC?
Yeah, so I mean, we exited that during March. It wasn't a long-term hold for us, and more around the, strategically, we like to own and control our investments by holding a 6.5% shareholding in another listed company. There was never going to be a long-term strategy for us, and they suspended their dividends for at least 3 years. We looked strategically at what we could do with recycling that capital if we had to dispose of those shares, and we disposed of the shares in March, and before the end of June we acquired the remaining 20% in Mall of Africa that we didn't own. So I think strategically a nice swap for us. And Mall of Africa, as one of the best performing super-regional malls in South Africa. We own the 80%. We manage 100% of the mall. We understand what the growth potential would looks like. So a great acquisition for us, and it's going to feature very prominently in the future of ATAC in Waterfall City.
I just want us, Raj, if you don't mind, to just go back to your debt strategy, right? So what's the next phase when you speak of entering the debt capital market?
Yeah, so between last year October and today, we've done a substantial amount of work around the balance sheet. We repaid 2.9 billion rands worth of debt. We refinanced a further 4.1 billion and reduced our weighted average margin by 30 basis points. The phase two of our debt strategy is to enter the debt capital markets, so effectively diversify our funding base from not just banks, but also to fixed income investors. To this end, we recently obtained our first credit rating from GCR, which was very well rated at A+. So it really positions us well to do a debt capital markets program. And we're expecting to do our maiden issuance before the end of October. So things are on track. Mm-hmm. And accessing the debt capital markets will not just diversify our funding base, but should come at a slightly lower cost of debt as well. So that should also feature in sort of the longer term prospects for the group.
Right. We mentioned the occupancy rate and collection rates in the beginning, in the introduction. What would you put the success down to?
Yeah, I mean, during the year, we filled up almost 9,000 square meters of space, and a lot of that in Waterfall City, but also in some of our assets outside of Waterfall City. And I think that the key success factor for Waterfall City is that, it's a smart, safe, sustainable city. We've been looking after both the security as well as some of the infrastructure like roads and lights, etc. And so our clients and our shoppers really enjoy being there, and it's, I think, relatively easier to fill space in a growing node with strong demand. So, you know, we'll, I think, continue to fill up some of those occupancies. Some of the vacancy that you see at year end was due to developments that were completed in May. And so we didn't have, you know, all the time to fill that space up. But I'm sure before the calendar year is over, we'll chip away at that 92% and bring it up closer to 100%.
Okay. You speak of customer and client satisfaction. Touch wood, we haven't had load shedding as bad in the past couple of months or so. But you've also, looked ahead and tried to mitigate this by installing PV systems.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's not just to mitigate load shedding. I think it really is to generate clean energy and sort of more renewable energy. Over the last 12 months, we've installed 12 rooftop PV systems, roughly 2.28 megawatts worth of power. And we're on track to reach our three-year target at the end of next financial year to have 7 megawatts installed. And so I think it's a great story. It's not just bringing down the sort of the overall cost for the group, but switching from diesel generators and Eskom power to renewable energy is always a good story. So yeah, glad that we're focused on this, and it's also meaningful in the bottom line, contributing to our overall growth and profitability.
Right. When we look at the strategic vision for the group, you've introduced Horizon 2023. Your vision for the future. Talk us through it.
Yeah. So I think quite ambitious of us to look forward and setting ourselves targets for what is the sort of the next 6 years, and it really cuts across the entire organization, from our people to our assets to our long-term profitability, etc. So we launched this earlier this year with one of our staff functions and got the buy-in from everyone, and like I said, it cuts across the entire business. It looks at our digital systems and how we go about doing business, and I think getting everyone within the tech to drive this has been a great sort of unification factor as well. So looking forward to the next 6 years of this 2030 journey.
What's life without ambition? Thank you very much, Raj, for your time this evening. Raj Nana, he is the Chief Financial Officer at ATTAC.
Is Bitcoin mining about to take off in South Africa? There's plenty of surplus solar power in the country after years of load shedding that we experienced, with a shortage in clients. My name is Karel Jager, Research Group Leader at the CSIR and CEO of Silver Sixpence, and I will be on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast with Kieran Ryan, where we will unpack this, and we'll also talk about ExoChain, a new tool that we developed at the CSIR to track down stolen crypto.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to the Market Update on SAFM.
Food producer Lipstar, whose products include Lancewood and Denny Mushrooms, among others, has reported a strong first half boosted by a resilient trading performance, improved profit margins and lower net finance costs. Revenue rose 5.2% to 5.81 billion rand, driven by the strong performance of the ambient products category, which grew revenue by 9.1%. The group's gross profit margin increased to 21.5% and cash generated from operations increased by 2.1 million rand, or just over. CEO of Lipstar, Charles de Villiers, is standing by to talk us through the group's performance. Thank you very much, sir, for your time this evening. How would you characterize the results?
Thank you. I think we would be overall pleased with the result, given the fact that a year ago we launched a new strategic direction to simplify the group's portfolio and operating structure, but also to deliver the growth that we saw in the first half of the year.
Let's break up the performance by categories and take a look at volume sales for the ambient products category.
Within ambient products, we saw a strong pipeline of export orders translate into positive operating leverage within that in that category. So quite pleased with the result in that business, although we did experience some challenges in our food service and retail sectors within that channel. However, also contributing to the result of the category, seeing an improvement in our contract manufacturing volumes, particularly of wet condiments in that category.
Right. And when we take a look at the revenue for the perishable products category?
Within the perishables products category, we were impacted by some supply diversification from a large customer in the food service channel, putting some pressure on our volumes. However, seeing a resilient performance from our dairy and our convenience meal subcategories in that super category.
What of the household and personal care category?
That's a category that we have noted that we would be exiting in the set of results. We announced the disposal of our Chet Chemicals business, leaving only our Contactim business remaining within that category. We have managed to improve margins in that business, mainly through procurement savings and operational efficiencies in order to deliver an improved result year on year.
Mm-hmm. Are you making progress in efforts to reduce exposure to non-food categories?
Absolutely. I mentioned in this morning's presentation that the Chet Chemicals sale is a significant step forward towards simplifying our portfolio. We also mentioned the closure of our beverage manufacturing operations from the end of August. So all of these actions driving us towards creating a portfolio which is focused around value-added food products, with hopefully more rationalization of the portfolio to come in the second half.
Does that mean that the group is on track to finalize the simplification of its operating structures within the newly established perishables products?
Certainly so. It's been a long journey of 18 months, but in doing that, I think we leave the portfolio much stronger and simplified for growth in the year of the new financial year of 2025.
Speaking of growth, maybe you can expand for us in terms of the outlook for the group.
We mentioned this morning that consumers remain under pressure. It's clear that, in terms of shopping behavior, the pack sizes and the volume pressure that we experience within retail. However, our portfolio also lends itself to a strong export portfolio, and as such, we will be driving the second half performance by executing on that strong pipeline of food service of export orders, as well as to continue to develop our retail channel through targeted promotional activity.
Thank you so much for your time this evening, CEO of Lipstar, Charles de Villiers.
The Property Pod.
Impact entrepreneur in property, Jonathan Liebman, the brainchild behind the Maboneng precinct in the Joburg CBD, has ventured into the tourism sector and hotels specifically. Liebman is now one of the driving forces behind Black Brick Apart Hotels as a co-founder. On the Property Pod this week, he shares insight on the new venture, which has emerged as Africa's fastest growing apartment hotel network.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
So in February this year, the African Development Bank Group, in its macroeconomic performance and outlook report, noted that the African continent, with all its 55 countries, will account for 11 of the world's 20 fastest growing economies in 2024. The report predicted that real gross domestic product, or GDP, growth for the continent is expected to average 3.8% and 4.2% in 2024 and 2025, respectively. In the same breath, though, the African Union has noted that governments on the African continent spend some 3.5% on their GDP on infrastructure development over the last 20 years. Asanda Tsotsi is head of project and export finance at Standard Bank Group CIB. He argues that Africa's infrastructure crisis requires urgent collaboration in a thought piece titled exactly that. He joins us now to outline some of the challenges, but more importantly, the solutions. Mr. Tsotsi, thank you very much for your time this evening. Perhaps let's start with outlining the continent, which is very vast, might we also add, in terms of infrastructure. What is the outlook?
Hi, Dudu. Thank you very much for having me. I think it's an important question that you ask. I mean, infrastructure development obviously has a positive effect on economic growth and poverty alleviation. This is well documented. And so adequate infrastructure is critical for the continent to drive economic growth, create jobs, as well as alleviate poverty. And so in different markets on the continent, we are seeing some investments that governments are making in infrastructure. I think South Africa is a good example of where we are starting to see some positive traction as it relates to infrastructure.
As we mentioned, with the African Union also noting that inadequate infrastructure has led to the reduction of national economic growth by some 2% annually in most countries on the continent. What are some of the ideas that perhaps your group is thinking about in terms of turning the tide?
Yeah, thanks, Dudu. I think one of the first things is really just around, getting bankable projects on stream. I think what we find, that same report from the AFDB notes that the continent annually has $100 billion infrastructure gap. And that is really largely caused by the unavailability of bankable projects. And by that, we're talking about projects that are economically viable, so they can repay the debt facilities that they take out. They are socially viable, meaning that communities can benefit from these projects as well as the fiscus. And obviously from an environmental perspective as well, they meet, Equator principles as well as IFC performance standards. And you have regulatory and political frameworks that enable them. And so that is a critical piece, that we need in place in order to drive investment in infrastructure. But we also argue that collaboration is a critical part of this, and that is collaboration between the public sector as well as the private sector. So I mentioned earlier, we are starting to see public-private partnerships coming through, which is a big positive. But we also need to see collaboration within public entities and within the private sector as well. And so that is our main argument, that bankable projects as well as collaboration will be critical in driving Africa's infrastructure.
What are bankable projects? Because when you speak of repaying debt facilities, socially viable projects, environmental factors, you take a look at some countries on the continent where raw minerals are unearthed and they're taken out. Perhaps that sector, you'll see a company building a road so they're able to access those, and a road maybe leading to the airport. But when you speak of the rest of the communities, do they benefit as much? So when we speak of bankable projects, what are we talking about?
So bankable really talks about the viability of the project. And so, you can have instances where the state, undertakes these projects and pays for them through the fiscus. But that is obviously on the back of these projects being beneficial for communities, so hospitals, bridges, roads, etc. So that's a portion or a part of what would be via bankable project projects. But as I said as well, these projects need to serve the communities. And if they are white elephants, then of course, they are of no use to communities. They will not drive economic growth, they will not create employment, and they will not alleviate poverty ultimately.
You argue in your thought piece that reforms by governments are critical. What kind of reforms?
So, Dudu, as a good example is what we've seen in South Africa with Operation Vulindlela, at least the first phase of it. We've seen quite a number of unlocks coming out of that. The work done by NECOM with regard to the electricity crisis, I think we are over 160 days now without load shedding. And so, we're also seeing National Treasury re-looking at the public-private partnership regulatory framework you know, which is critical to drive private sector participation in these projects.
You mentioned bankable projects, but also the word collaborations being quite important. How so? Collaboration between?
So collaboration, with a number of stakeholders. So in the first instance, really between the private sector and the public sector, this is where, you know, we have been referring, I guess, to public-private partnerships, you know, which are critical unlocks. The other piece is that there's a lot of skill set that sits in the private sector, you know, which can be seconded, you know, to the public sector. So these are experienced bankers, you know, who have finance projects all over the continent. And so, you know, sharing those kind of resources between the private and the public sector is also critical and will ensure that, you know, you bring the requisite knowledge and experience into the development of these projects.
You also argue that incorporating climate resilience into infrastructure planning and financing will be crucial. The continent is not an island. We're not exempt from climate change.
That is a critical piece. I mean, if you look at the continent right now, you know, we have the least resilient infrastructure amongst all of the continents when it comes to climate change. I mean, you've seen, you know, how the floods in KZN disproportionately affect the poor. And so the argument that we also make is that we need to use ESG as a mechanism to really leapfrog our infrastructure challenges. So build infrastructure that is that contributes positively or mitigates climate change. And at the same time, obviously, you know, infrastructure that will help us improve the resilience to adverse weather events.
Energy transition. Those two words we've heard quite a lot in South Africa, right? But there are other parts of the continent where this is also a conversation that is being had. How important is it for investors to understand each region or the market that you're entering into, more so when we speak of some of the natural resources that are in some countries, right? They can't immediately move away from those minerals.
Dudu, that's a very important point. What tends to happen with the energy transition is that investors tend to see it as a homogeneous event that, you know, all of us must follow all the countries, all 55 countries you mentioned earlier, on the continent must follow the same transition pathway. But the reality is that, you know, not all countries are blessed with the solar resource as well as wind resource that South Africa has. You know, if you look at a country like Nigeria, for instance, it is well endowed in gas. And gas is a transition fuel, so to speak. If you look at Kenya, it's geothermal. And so the argument here is that we cannot apply a one-size-fits-all. And so it's important as an investor to understand that, you know, these nuances when you go into these markets to invest in the energy transition.
Mm-hmm. We cannot speak about that and not speak about the Africa Continental Free Trade Area, because when we speak of infrastructure, as that conversation is gaining momentum and more countries are ratifying, if we do not have the requisite infrastructure, never mind the other administrative stuff that is involved, but if we don't have the basic infrastructure, just how far back are we setting ourselves in an attempt to move forward?
I mean, interestingly, Dudu, there is some stats out that say that inadequate infrastructure actually increases the cost of goods traded between African countries by between 30% to 40%. And so effectively what that means is that our goods that we trade amongst ourselves are expensive, number one, and we cannot find markets for them outside of the continent because they can't compete you know, with goods manufactured elsewhere in the world. And so, you know, this investment in infrastructure, making sure that railway corridors work that connect different countries, that we have ports that are functioning properly and are able to receive and dispatch goods as and when needed. Roads, bridges that connect communities to ensure that trade is happening amongst the different countries. And so that is critical to make the African or ACTA work efficiently.
You also argue that the other key component of infrastructure finance is the private sector. When we speak about collaborations and also the involvement of the private sector, what is it that you are experiencing, right? Because you'll find sometimes, more so in business speak, they say, well, it's kind of hard to invest in the African continent. Is that the reality that you are faced with as you enter different markets because of some of these challenges when it comes to infrastructure?
I would say, Dudu, that the investors that we meet really want to invest in the continent. The pension fund as well as sovereign wealth funds, sit with around $100 trillion of assets under management, that they want to deploy into infrastructure. And so there is a want to invest in infrastructure. I think the main issues that prevent this from happening are some of the things that we chatted about earlier. So there isn't sufficient bankable projects to allow that infrastructure investment. It can be also that regulatory frameworks are not in place to accept, that foreign direct investment.
Well, it sounds like a missed opportunity. Am I correct in that assessment?
It is really a big missed opportunity. The good thing, though, is that it's not too late. That we can get this right. But obviously, the critical piece is that as I mentioned in the piece, we do need to collaborate between the public and the private sector. Make sure that we are leading, I guess, in thought leadership, and speaking to our governments about what we have seen that works in other countries and jurisdictions. Now, we can't replicate, what happens elsewhere, but certainly there are some good ideas that are happening in other parts of the continent, that we can impart in our jurisdictions.
What do you say to a listener that is thinking, for how much longer? It would appear that we communicate in silos as a continent, and not necessarily, maybe, like you said, it's a missed opportunity, but utilizing the opportunities that we have, because you've got some 500 million sub-Saharan Africans who lack access to basics, electricity being one of them.
Yeah, look, and I would say to those people, and you're quite right, but I would say to those people that, certainly communication is improving amongst, the different countries on the continent. I think we saw last week 53 African countries represented in China for a big, strategic engagement with the Chinese government. So I would say that we are starting to talk with one voice as a continent. And I certainly believe that we are not too far from a future where, Africa has adequate infrastructure, that every last, person has access to electricity. This is certainly our hope.
Right. Perhaps I condemn unreasonably. Maybe we could look at shining stars, but maybe let's look at where infrastructure is really functioning and or there's progress that is being made. From the work that you do, which markets are you finding are actually getting along with it?
Yeah, so I mean, there's good work in many of the markets that we operate in. So I would be remiss to name them.
Okay.
But certainly, I mean, if we look at East Africa, there's a big investment in the rail network through the SGR projects. You know, if we look at, as I said, South Africa, we are talking about a big investment in transmission lines. So a transmission company is looking at those types of investments. Transnet is looking to invest in its ports. You know, we see the process, I guess, of the public-private partnership happening there as well. And so there are really pockets of excellence. There are really pockets of excellence. And as I say, I think things are moving in the right direction.
All right. Thank you very much, sir, for your contribution this evening. Asanda Tsotsi is head of project and export finance at Standard Bank CIB.
Hello, Jeremy Maggs here. I've just finished recording the next episode of Fix SA on MoneyWeb. I'm in conversation with the former chief executive of the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and soldier, Roy Anderson. We'll be looking at leadership style and approach when it comes to solving problems, comparing the role of discipline in military and civilian leadership and strategies for setting and achieving goals under pressure. Join me, Jeremy Maggs, and South Africa's top leaders on the fortnightly MoneyWeb Fix SA podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
The Property Pod.
Impact entrepreneur in property, Jonathan Liebman, the brainchild behind the Maboneng precinct in the Joburg CBD, has ventured into the tourism sector and hotels specifically. Liebman is now one of the driving forces behind Black Brick Apart Hotels as a co-founder. On the Property Pod this week, he shares insight on the new venture, which has emerged as Africa's fastest growing apartment hotel network.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb. Your trusted source for business and investment insights.
The Market Update, Monday to Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m.
Hello again. So South Africa has entered into 8 agreements with China following the attendance of a delegation led by President Cyril Ramaphosa of the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, a summit between China and all the African countries, which the President of the Republic has hailed as successful. From the export of manufactured goods to beef, government officials are optimistic that the trade imbalance between Beijing and Johannesburg will be reversed through these agreements. So what is different this time around, you may be wondering? Well, Wolf Brody is with the Agriculture Business Chamber of South Africa. Thank you very much, Wolf, for your time this evening. Maybe let's start with exactly that. What is different this time around, more so maybe for your sector?
Thanks very much. Yeah, I much appreciate the chance to have a chat. I would say that for us the biggest difference is that we went in with a very specific list, and you know, the last FOCAC was held in 2021. That was during the COVID era, of course, and you know, during COVID it was extremely difficult in terms of getting exports out of the country into China. There was virtual inspections, there were incredibly strict COVID regulations, the volume of trade was impacted, the procedures were very difficult. So for this FOCAC, we actually then caucused amongst the agricultural sector, and we said, what are the barriers you're experiencing? We went in there having briefed Minister Steenhuisen. We then left our government ministers, Minister Tao, Minister Steenhuisen, and their senior officials to go into the negotiations. And some of our CEOs went across, and I was across there as well. So we had beef sector, citrus sector. But we ended up with some very practical outcomes, which is very helpful around beef, around dairy, around wool, around pet food. And we're looking forward to nailing down some more in the gap between now and next year's G20 meetings, where President Xi will come to South Africa.
Mm. When you speak of difficult procedures, more so in moving goods, currently China bans all South African beef imports. That is in the event diseases such as foot and mouth break out anywhere in the country. But this time around, with the signed deal, they have agreed that in future they will block beef imports only from the region in the country where the disease occurred. A welcome move?
Yeah, no, very much so. You know, internationally, that's generally the rule. You don't do a blanket country ban. You ban the export from the region or district where the outbreak occurs, and it's something that is most welcome. You know, we had the general ban lifted in August last year, but this then finalizes it and definitely gives a green light to that process, and that means the South African beef sector can then export, you know, from other regions in the country where it's free of foot and mouth disease, etc. And this is also very welcome because we're seeking the same outcome for our pork sector, for the exports to China. At the moment, there's disagreement between South Africa and China in terms of the same process, the same principle. So what we'd like to see is that bans are placed on regions where there's animal health issues around pork, and then for the other regions that are disease-free, we can export to China. And of course, China is a fantastic pork market. You know, they have an amazing variety of pork dishes. It's really a part of the food culture, and it's something that could really, you know, revitalize and boost our pork sector in South Africa. Mm.
The president also mentioned that these meetings, if you will, are aimed at addressing the trade imbalance, which is something that doesn't necessarily impact the agricultural sector. But what has been the level of engagement with your stakeholders for the long term?
Well, you know, we are blessed with a positive trade balance with China, and that means we export more than we import, and that's partly due to the, you know, the quality and the reliability of the South African supplies, and it's especially it will actually be even more in our favor now with the entrance of the beef and the other exports into China. But in terms of the overall picture for agriculture, what we're seeing and what we expect to see more of is that the various commodities will increase production, and those increases in production will, instead of going to the EU, the US, or the UK, will be channeled and funneled into China, and where there's similar protocols being signed in India and Japan, they'll go into there. But the Chinese market is so massive. I mean, for example, as an anecdote, there's a colleague telling me that for citrus, that if the Chinese market went up by 1% in terms of demand for citrus, that's equivalent to the entire consumption demand of Germany for South African exports.
Mm. And when we talk short term, I guess, with your deliberations, when you go back to your stakeholders and telling them this is what transpired in China, are you able to share with us what it is that we can expect in the short term, at least, if anything at all?
Well, you know, this has been on the table as a negotiation point for months, if not years, for the commodities, what we'll very likely see is almost immediately a response. Not within weeks, but I would say within months. Like, let's say, looking at beef, for example, since that ban was lifted in August last year, in the 6 months to date, first two quarters of this year, it's been the biggest jump in beef exports of these two quarters in the last 8 years, you know, of a comparable 6 month period. And it's really also due to the Saudi agreement that was reached with Saudi Arabia, the similar sort of agreement on phytosanitary protocols. But you can see the response. That Saudi agreement was signed in late 2022, and then it was finalized early 2023 in terms of the nuts and bolts. So there's about a sort of a half a year to a year lag, and then you really see things ramp up. And in terms of beef, you know, we'll have to get a sense of the consumer preferences. I believe the colleagues already know exactly where to pitch their products, so it's going to matter of tweaking what we put out there. But I think very shortly, you know, Avos, for example, are also going to China for the first time now in September. Mm. It's really good news. It's the first shipment going in. So 6 months to a year's time, we'll see a real boost in exports going out. And that will translate into money in the pocket for South African growers and South African farmers and you know, beef and dairy farmers.
Mm. Avos, it is obvious. And for meat lovers, it is obvious. But maybe you can share with us, what is it about our meat that is so attractive?
Well, we actually now have an interesting challenge ahead of us, because the Chinese preference in terms of meat is for a more marbled meat, a meat with a higher fat content than we traditionally export. Mm. Now, New Zealand meets that requirement quite nicely, and they have the advantage of airlifting because they're right next door. But essentially, we have to then focus, you know, our exports on a particular segment in the market. And for China, the best thing to do is to focus on the high end of the market. And so what that means is that we have to adjust the timeline in terms of the fattening of the calves and the weaners on our side. And it's going to be industry sort of commercial calculations in terms of what's going to bring the best return and what's the best, most cost efficient. But in China, there's very specific tastes around beef that then we will match, because beef has not traditionally been a huge product in China, because decades ago, the government had pretty much bans on beef consumption, because cattle were valued for their use in agriculture to pull plows and etc. That's why pork is so widely consumed, and not so much poultry and not so much beef. But we can definitely meet those consumer preferences in China. We have the capacity, and definitely have the capacity within our beef sector. The guys are very very capacitated.
Absolutely. Does that then mean that there's room, or more room is being created in the market for new players to enter? In South Africa, at least.
Yeah, no. This is what we hope will happen, because you know there's any number of export development programs across the various commodities, both plant and animal, and there's small scale grower development programs, and of course the returns from export markets are traditionally better than local returns. The local market is more stable, risk free, especially with our logistics challenges that we have and getting stuff off out the ports. But still, at the same time, to be able to get into a solid export channel, like, for example, into the EU market, has always had a better return, for example, in the fruit sector. And it's really good news for emerging growers, and particularly also because we have a lot of state land that is getting released and is going to be coming into production. And we have there's a lot of plans between land bank and industry and government in terms of how to increase actually the area under production. And just in terms of land that, you know, over the decades has gone out of production, that could be brought back into production. What you need for something like that is you need demand. And the local market is pretty much saturated. And then at the same time, all of the fruit commodities, for example, have production increases in the pipeline. With citrus, it's up to like 25%. With grapes, you're talking about up to about 7%. With the deciduous, you're talking into double digits as well. All of the commodities have been planting and growing new trees, young trees, and those are now coming to fruition. With citrus, in fact, they have a plan to add another 100 million cartons by the early 2030s. Mm-hmm. And all of that is reliant on government and industry opening up export markets. Okay. And that's why we really are very thankful to both Department of Agriculture and Department of Trade and Industry and DIRCO and the respective ministers and President Ramaphosa, because, you know, it is tough negotiations. You don't get anything for nothing. And our partners, the Chinese, of course, want to see value for what they concede on. So we're very glad to have come away with practical commercial realities in our hands.
While the administrative processes are taking place, when you speak of demand more so, or rather, maybe you can tell us about the intricacies of meeting demand, more so when it comes to what? It hasn't rained maybe in Gauteng, at least for Yongs. We can't remember the last time we had rain. So situations that are outside of your control, right? Like the weather.
Yeah. You know, this is the thing about farming. That's why they always say that farming is something that's not for you know, it's not something that's easily undertaken. Mm-hmm. You know, modern farming is also very complex. It's a whole value chain. There's a lot of services and elements that go into modern farming, especially in the South African context. But at the end of the day, you know, you can get everything right, and then zap, there's hail, and you're like, you know, you wake up, you're like, really? There's only so much you can do. Yeah. You can be insured, and it's just like, bam, you're gone.
Sure.
And you've got to have the resilience to get up and say, okay, on we go. But at the same time, that's not a consistent pattern. You don't get constant disasters in agriculture. You get these things that appear out of the blue. But at the same time, it also doesn't mean that an entire industry is flattened, or that you lose your entire blueberry crop for the whole country, or your entire citrus crop. Like with the floods in the Western Cape, there were only portions of production that were flooded and damaged. And same with hail. But at the same time, it means that you have fluctuations in supply. But fortunately, South Africa is such a significant agricultural producer. Most people didn't realize that we, for example, the second largest citrus producer exporter in the world. We're the largest macadamia exporter, largest chicory exporter, largest mealy meal exporter, and our grapes and pears are in the top 10. We really have a very efficient, very cost-competitive, high levels of research and development agricultural sector. Very, very, very competitive. So once we get into a market, we're actually able to supply that market. And in fact, the only thing that's been tripping us up really has been the logistics. We joke and call it a self-imposed trade barrier. Yeah.
Unfortunately. Wolf, thank you very much for your grace, because also I can hear you're a little bit thirsty. So we're going to let you make it rain on your throat and lubricate your throat.
No.
Thank you very much for your time this evening. Wolf Brody, manager at the Agriculture Business Chamber of South Africa. And that's it from myself and the team as I get flagged to wrap up the show. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. If you missed any of our conversations, moneyweb.co.za. Have yourselves a magic evening. Bahaichu. Pulakio.